Welcome to Afternoon Light, the podcast of the Robert Menzies Institute. In this special six-part summer series, you will hear recordings of papers delivered at the Robert Menzies Institute's conference on the Menzies Ascendancy, Implementing a Liberal Agenda and Consolidating Gains, 1954 to 1961. The conference was held over 2 days from the 23rd to the 24th of November 2023. In today's episode of the summer series, you will hear from leading Australian political journalist Paul Kelly, followed by historian and writer Anne Henderson on Menzies, Evatt and the Labor split, and finally, Professor Paul Strangio on the Labor split in Victoria, the bedrock of Menzies' ascendancy.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, former ministers, members of the Menzies family, it's a privilege for me to deliver this opening address to the third annual conference of the Robert Menzies Institute. I thank Georgina for her welcome and for her leadership of the Institute. Unfortunately, I never met Robert Menzies, but starting work in the Prime Minister's Department in East Block in 1969, just 3 years after his retirement, I was regaled with Menzies' stories about Scotch or cricket or his insistence on proper process. But I think my real link with Menzies was through his voice, that compelling voice coming through the radio, made for Parliament and for public speaking. Menzies belonged to a different age, but he had that eternal, indispensable quality for the successful politician. He knew how to persuade. He was the supreme orator. His voice attracted like a magnet. My friend, the late John Nethercutt, told me of a discussion he had with Sir Robert's biographer, Alan Martin. Martin had said to John, "You were the first person who told me I was doing important work rather than wasting my time on Menzies." The comment testifies to the intellectual torpor that long surrounded attitudes towards Menzies, notably from the academy. Australia was transformed as a country between 1949 and 1966, the period of Menzies' second prime ministership. As John Howard said, Menzies' greatest legacy as a statesman was to lay the foundations of modern Australia. One reason critics have tried to ignore Menzies' story is because they dislike the modern Australia that he shaped. Menzies was the slayer of Labor dreams, and that has not been readily forgiven. Now, in my comments today, I want to make some broad observations about Menzies and then make some direct remarks about the period being reviewed, 54 to 61. In my view, debate about Menzies has been bedeviled by several factors. First, the sheer longevity of his governance defies easy branding or interpretation. When Menzies was Prime Minister, the United States had four presidents, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy and Johnson. The United Kingdom had six Prime Ministers, Attlee, Churchill, Eden, Macmillan, Douglas Home and Wilson. The length of the Menzies political era encompasses a series of shorter yet decisive political eras. Accordingly, there are many manifestations of Menzies. The champion of free enterprise against nationalisation, the anti-communist at home, the full employment high-growth specialist, the manufacturing industry protectionist, the Cold War pro-American warrior, the Queen's man, the messiah for the forgotten people, the education prime minister, the architect of the Vietnam commitment, and upholder of white Australia. The task of grappling with the full Menzies portrait has always been daunting, and historians and academics have struggled before it. I've always seen the Menzies prime ministership in four phases. The survival period, 49 to 54, with the 54 election being the decisive moment when his entire project was most threatened. The Menzies consolidation, 54 to 61, that saw his unrivalled command of the nation across three election victories. The recovery phase, 61 to 63, when Menzies, in his sixth term with Labor's help, staged a resurgence after the 1961 perilously close election, achieving a strong victory at the 1963 election, and the final phase, the mid-1960s phase, the passing of the Menzian age, when the discontinuity between a changing nation and Menzies' stubborn and rigid attitudes as Prime Minister became apparent. The irony of the Menzies Prime Ministership is the insistence by many of his critics that while Australia changed, this apparently had little to do with Menzies. In his 1964 book, The Lucky Country, Donald Horne said Menzies did little that really mattered, and that his greatest talent was to preside over events and look as if he knew what they were all about. In short, Menzies apparently dominated the age, but somehow, some way, wasn't responsible for what happened to Australia. In this sense, such confused critiques could be seen as a tribute to Menzies. His skill was a reassurance. Menzies underpromised and overdelivered. He presided over extraordinary changes in Australia's economy, society, and population, yet created the impression that either nothing much dramatic was happening or that progress was in safe hands. A bit of both, I think. Menzies was an incrementalist, a proponent of managed change, a champion of continuity. Where Gough Whitlam exaggerated change to promote himself, Menzies downplayed change to keep the public assured. The upshot is that many critics fell into the ludicrous claim that nothing of importance really happened in Australia between 49 and 66. Other critics suggest Menzies' success is more about Labor weakness and the ALP split than Menzies' own skill. Yet a leader can only defeat the rivals he faces. And Menzies had the ascendancy over both H.V. Evatt and Arthur Calwell. It was the Labor veteran Clyde Cameron who famously said, "He looked like a PM, he behaved like a PM, and he had the presence of a PM." How many PMs since Menzies could justify that description? Some, but not too many. The ALP split became pivotal to the extent of Menzies' dominance. But I believe Menzies would have won in 55 and 58 even without the split. He still had Dr. Evatt. And I think Evatt never recovered from the Petroff Royal Commission and his 1954 defeat. The 1961 election was different. The DLP saved Menzies at this election. That is, without the split, Menzies would have lost in 61 and his prime ministership would have been 11 years or five terms. Menzies overall was assisted by luck, notably the emergence of the DLP, but he also made his own luck. Witness his path-breaking support for state aid before the 63 election. The bottom line assessment remains. You can only be judged against your opponents at the time. In the aftermath of his retirement, Menzies suffered because of the cult of the 1960s. Its mission was to denigrate the 1950s as a time of boredom and reaction. The 1960s cult was driven by cultural and social change enshrined as progress. The swinging 60s of the Beatles, abandonment of personal inhibition, campaigns for political rights, and massive government interventions typecast the 50s as holding back the tide of progress. In her 1963 book, The Feminine Mystique, Betty Friedan claimed the suburbs were burying women alive. In America, the Kennedy glamour mocked the Eisenhower passivity. In Australia, the coalition, anxious to consign the Menzies age to history almost as soon as Menzies left, we saw Harold Holt casting himself as a more modern liberal and then John Gorton trying to market himself as a change agent. Recent decades, however, have seen a more realistic interpretation of the 1950s. Indeed, surveys in recent years in America have shown that Eisenhower now ranks number five in the list of best presidents, suggesting high-quality political management somewhere in the 1950s. The Menzies reassessment is assisted by another factor, The disappointing performance of our political elites and prime ministers since John Howard left politics. In a sense, the more time advances, the more people are inclined to ask, how did Menzies do it? Who was he? What made his success? The keys, I believe, to Menzies' success were his sustained intellectual philosophy of liberalism, his policy and political judgment, his leadership of the party, preserving internal unity, and his persuasion with the public. His values were remarkably consistent. Individual freedom, personal responsibility, private enterprise, patriotism, self-reliance, prudence, and self-restraint. Writing of Menzies, Sir John Bunting said, he was, without any doubt, the boss. Menzies slept well. He could dismiss the day and get untroubled sleep. He was able to manage pressure. He knew at a deep level how the system worked, the executive, the parliament, the public service. He reflected and learnt from the mistakes of his initial leadership. Bunting said, Menzies always seemed to know what the core of a matter was. He knew that the most urgent problems were not always the most important. Most of all, he would know which was the critical point. I can still hear him say to me, to others, to his cabinet, now there it is, that is the determining factor. Governing was easier in the Menzies era, much easier. The incessant demands of the 24-hour media cycle and scores of lobby groups did not exist. Governing was slower. It was an age of conformity, an age of mass loyalty, the time of big corporations, big unions, big churches, big mass media, and a PM dealt with concentrated, organised institutional power. Class divisions were set, but not the cultural divides that fracture society today. Menzies governed before the fax machine, colour television, talkback radio, morning television, the mobile phone and social media. He understood how the industrial age worked and was spared the anarchic nature of the digital age. Looking at the three terms from 54 to 61, it was a time of extraordinary Menziesian ascendancy. I see this period as shaped by three pervasive themes. The construction of Australia's middle-class prosperity, the promotion in the widest sense of Australia's national development, and the entrenchment at home and abroad of an anti-communist foreign and security policy and promotion of defence via great and powerful friends. These themes under Menzies became the Liberal Party's ideological DNA. They became the meaning of the party, and they remain to this day. John Howard likes telling the story of how Alan Greenspan told him at their first meeting, Australia has the biggest middle class in the world. Greenspan didn't know, but this was the ultimate tribute to Menzies. Menzies' initial victory in 1949 was for free enterprise against nationalisation. And it's tempting, given the Attlee legacy in Britain, to see the 49 election as the most enduring in our history. It's when people voted for free enterprise over socialism. But the point is, Menzies had to deliver on the economy. And he did in the 1950s. He benefited from the long post-war boom, and Australia's results were remarkable. Over 15 years from 1950, annual GDP growth was above 4%. Average per capita income growth was 2%. Figures to make the current generation weep. Inflation was low. Unemployment averaged below 2%. There was prosperity, and it was widely spread. Home ownership during the Menzies age rose from just above 50% to just under 70%. It was the Keynesian age, or in Australia, the age of fine-tuning of the economy. Economic growth was driven by domestic demand, high immigration, and capital inflow. Manufacturing expanded behind high tariffs, a highly centralised industrial relations system with union membership of the workforce at above 60% did the job. Real wage gains, no wage breakouts. The economic technocrats of the Menzian age delivered. Their record growth was impressive, but their model was mired in deepening inefficiencies that would erupt in the 1970s and 80s. As Ergas and Pinkers argue, most Australian economists at the time were supportive of the economic model. The notion of the reform age, as we talk about today, didn't exist. Why would it? The structural economic crisis was in the future, not now. The notion of a reform agenda, as we understand it from the 1980s, was not yet in existence. The real agenda was growth and national development. The Menzian economy was creating a free enterprise middle class, the like of which Australia had never seen. But the flaws in the model would be exposed by changes in the global economy after Menzies' departure. The great victim, ironically, was Gough Whitlam in his epic 1972 Big Government Promises, which assumed a continuation of the Menzian growth model. The second theme I identify is national development. When I arrived in Canberra, this idea was everywhere. From the minerals boom to Japan trade to expanding higher education to Australia's extraordinary high immigration program. Menzies championed much of the Chifley government initiatives, the Snowy Mountains scheme, expanding manufacturing industry, and increasing Australia's population. In 20 years, Australia accepted more than 2 million migrants. Immigrants accounted for 70% of the increase in the workforce in the 1950s. Arthur Cornwell said introducing the program in the 1940s, there was a risk of World War III. The security factor was fundamental in underpinning the program. Menzies, British to his boot heels, pursued the search for migrants far beyond Britain, creating the conditions for a transformed Australia, eventually a multicultural Australia, of a dimension I doubt he would have approved. In 1957, Menzies accepted the Murray Report on the expansion of university education in Australia. The Commonwealth would begin to move to establish responsibility and funding for its university sector. Menzies got there, initially reluctant, not as a visionary reformer, but as a practical man. He didn't believe there were votes in it, but felt it was the right step for a growing nation. His view of universities was idealistic, probably naive, influenced by Oxbridge, but an expression of his liberalism and his conviction that education was the path to individual fulfilment and strengthening Australia's democracy and capability. The surge into universities over the next 15 years was extraordinary in transforming Australia's professional class, though I suspect Menzies would have reservations if he looked at the university model we see today. And finally, the third theme I identify in the period of consolidation is national security. Menzies governed during the Cold War, the nuclear age, the contest between communism and democracy, the legacy of the 1949 Chinese Revolution, the fear of communism in Asia, and the Korean War. He was a foreign policy realist. His outlook was shaped by World War II, and his method was to seek closer ties with the US and UK in an agenda of forward defence in the region. The ANZUS Treaty was negotiated. Australia committed to the Korean War. Menzies for some time had great hopes for SETO. The government, keen to add meaning to the US alliance, opened the way for joint facilities, with the North West Cape base becoming an election issue in the 1960s. After Korea, there were three military commitments: the Malayan emergency, the Indonesian confrontation, and the Vietnam War. A decisive breakthrough was the 1957 Commerce Agreement with Japan. It was John McEwen's work, just as ANZUS was Spender's work. But the agreement had vast consequences for the future of economic and political relations between Australia and Japan. My final point. I think Menzies' commitments and policies during this consolidation phase created a framework and a concept of policy and ideological belief for the Liberal Party that has sustained it through all the decades since, even though circumstances have changed. In conclusion, I would reflect that Menzies' initial conception of the Liberal Party was to provide a voice to the middle class that had no voice, no organised power, no institutions to promote its interests. This was the meaning of the Liberal Party. It wasn't to be a party of business or trade unions or institutional power. When we observe the cultural transformation in Australia today, best represented in many ways by the recent Voice referendum, when virtually every institution in the power structure opposed the formal Liberal Party position, the Menziesian model looks strikingly relevant to the current situation. The gulf between elites and the people, between insiders and outsiders today, is stark and deeply meaningful. In this sense, it suggests a new and contemporary relevance for the Menzies vision. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to be here for this third conference discussing Menzies and his influence on Australian politics. It's a unique start for a conference on something like Robert Menzies to start with his opposition. We're starting with the Labor Party, in a sense. But my view is that the split in the Labor Party had a lot to do with Menzies. And it's been covered over by myths that the Labor Party has created over time. The great Labor Party split, I still believe, had a lot to do with the reason of the fact that Menzies was such a long-serving Prime Minister of Australia. He was undoubtedly the great winner of the split, 54-55. He was by no means an innocent bystander. Matched with his rival, Labor leader Bert Everett, he was a significant factor in the bitter divide that saw Labor in opposition federally for 23 years. The emphasis that has been placed on B.A. Santa Maria and his movement in the split has been exaggerated. It stems from decades of Labor historians accepting the line pushed by Everett at the time and articulated by Canberra journalist Alan Reid in collaboration with Everett, who wrote of Santa Maria as Svengali-like in the shadows, pulling the strings. This interpretation of the might of Santa Maria at the time, leaning heavily on sectarian suspicions of Catholics within Labor, owes much to the ignorance of how great Santa Maria's actual influence then was. Whatever his influence among anti-communist and mostly Catholic unionists and others, Santa Maria was a little-known political force in 1954 to 55. The movement was certainly one player in the split, but by no means the cause of it. In fact, Bill Barry, who led the group of Victorian Labor MPs across the floor in the Victorian Parliament to bring down the Kayne Labor government in April 1955, was not even a member of Santa Maria's movement. And according to Barry himself and Frank McManus, then Labor's Victorian Assistant Secretary and later a DLP Senator, Barry had never met Santa Maria. It was only later, as anti-communist Labor became the Democratic Labor Party, anti-communist Labor for a while before that, and after 1957, the Queensland Labor Party, and remember, 1957, it was late the split in Queensland, that's important, that Santa Maria came to public prominence and real influence. The NCC became the underbelly, a bit like the Australian Women's Group in the days of Lyons and others, the underbelly of those breakaway parties with anti-communist DLP and after 57 Queensland Labor Party preferences at elections in 55, 58 and 61 flowing to Robert Menzies' coalition. And as Paula said, in the very close 1965-61 federal election after the credit squeeze and to some extent Menzies' complacency that it was so easy to win with the split Labor Party. Queensland Labor Party preferences saved Jim Killen, and if they hadn't, Menzies would have had a hung parliament. So in my view, and I think the history shows it, the split made Santa Maria as much as it made Menzies. To fully understand the Labor split of 54-55, we need to look back at the Menzies-Evatt contest, which had endured for the best part of a decade by 1954. Their personal rivalry went back to Evatt's leaving the High Court to stand for Labor at the 1940 election, federal election. Evatt saw himself right then as a possible Labor Prime Minister. He saw it from the moment he entered Parliament, and he played all sorts of games to try and destabilise things or to get himself in a position where he could become the Labor leader. But Evatt would have his ambitions curtailed by the success of John Curtin and Ben Chifley as Prime Ministers through the following decade. Menzies and Evatt faced each other directly in a number of stoushes, significant contests from 1947. There was the Battle of the Banks, the 1951 campaign to ban the Communist Party of Australia, the federal election in 1954, which Evatt was certain he was going to win, and the Petrov Royal Commission after the election of 1954 into subversive activities involving the Soviet embassy in Canberra and various Australian operatives, some of whom, three, were linked to Evatt's office. In these big bouts, Menzies would lose to Evatt in just one. The 1951 referendum was narrowly lost, led by Menzies, to Evatt's campaign for no. And it is unusual that it was so narrowly lost. Referendums usually go quite differently. But from then on, Menzies' conviction that Australia faced a world endangered by the spread of communism in Europe and Asia, and his determination to call it out, even before 54, was instrumental in playing Evatt at his weakest points. In the end, it was Menzies who destroyed Evatt's ability to lead and unite Labor. As Menzies told Canberra journalist Frank Chamberlain just before the 1954 election, "Dr. Evatt is not a great Australian. He's a great man for Evatt. He's not interested in power for Australia. He's interested in power for Evatt. I would leave politics this 1954, but for Dr. Evatt. He's a menace to Australia and he must be kept out of office by hook or by crook." The rivalry between Menzies and Evatt was clear to their contemporaries, who noted over the years their parallel lives and intense competition, even their lack of regard for each other. After Menzies' resignation as Prime Minister in 41, Evatt's trajectory was in ascendance. As Australia's Attorney General, he gained world attention helping to set up the United Nations, something he was eternally proud of. Then, Evatt's failure before both the High Court and the Privy Council in the Chifley government's bank nationalisation case, followed by Menzies' Liberal Party win at the federal election of 1949, saw Evatt face his first real defeat in what had been a career of brilliant prizes. Menzies now became ascendant. As Evatt saw it, Menzies had stolen this brilliant boy's golden future. But Evatt remained in politics, and eventually, as new Labor leader after Ben Chifley's death in June 1951, his second chance at the greatest political prize came. Now, the move by Menzies to ban the Communist Party of Australia was made in the growing tension of the Cold War. Menzies' visit to Britain in 48, at the height of the Berlin blockade, had sharpened his view that the greatest danger to world peace was the growth of communism. Evatt, meanwhile, showed a more complacent attitude. He saw the United Nations and diplomacy as the way to peace, and seemingly to regard the Soviet Union as a reliable negotiator. The clash between Evatt and Menzies in the House of Representatives in February 1949 showed clearly the gap in the two men's perspectives. Evatt's constant push for dialogue through the United Nations to conciliate the Soviet Union was a stance that Menzies belittled as useless posturing in the face of danger. The split that decimated Labor in 54 and 55 had its origins in parliamentary politics and the lack of leadership shown by Bert Evatt. Former Labor MP Fred Daly recalled how the legislation to ban the Communist Party opened serious divisions in the Labor caucus from 1950, as Labor debated how to handle the legislation in the Senate. Daly wrote, Evatt, Chifley, Ward, Keon, Mullins, Rosvear, Caldwell, Burke, Victoria, Burke, WA and Pollard participated in emotional and hate-filled debates, and sometimes the meetings broke up in disarray. For all that, Chifley held the team together. By 1954, Menzies had Evatt's measure as Labor leader, along with a sound reading and intuition of the mood and politics of the time. Communism was a real concern, regardless of the outcome of the Communist Party dissolution referendum. But the overriding concern of voters was inflation. As he brought down his horror, as it was called, budget of 1951, Treasurer Artie Fadden said he made no apology for the increase in taxes, as inflation was a whirlwind sucking up income and jobs. And it worked. By 1953, in the budget, such was the improvement in the economy, taxes were eased and benefits increased. Menzies was called the man of the hour by one cartoonist. For all that, Labor had improved in the polls since 1951, and many journalists continued to view that a Labor victory looked likely at the 1954 election, at least, that is, until the early months of 1954. By then, the 1953 budget was taking effect, just as the young Queen Elizabeth and her handsome husband, Prince Philip, landed in Australia on the 3rd of February for an 8-week tour. Now, Menzies had no hand in that date because that had been put off because of the death of the King. Now, Australia had seen nothing like it. Huge crowds waved and cheered at every vantage point, streets hung with bunting and lights twinkled, while businesses from magazines to ice cream vendors around the country benefited from what seemed like one long, glorious party. I know I was there. I saw the Queen four times. Everyone was excited about it. Children went out at night to look at the lights. Before long, columnists were writing that the election would be close. The announcement of the defection of Vladimir Petrov, Third Secretary and Consul at the Soviet Embassy in Canberra on the 13th of April, just weeks before voting day on the 29th of May, was not something Menzies could control. The date had been fixed by negotiations between Petrov and ASIO. Petrov's wife, Evdokia, who also worked for the Soviet Embassy, and many of you will remember the scenes, defected in Darwin shortly after, following dramatic scenes at Sydney Airport. However, the legislation to set up the Petrov Royal Commission and its terms of reference was approved without division of Parliament, with Evatt as strong in his condemnation of communist espionage as Menzies. Then, within days, he was attacking Menzies for using the commission to condemn the Chifley government for being weak on security. And in time, he would accuse Menzies of using Petrov to damage Labor in the 54 election, the first of the rabbits in the hat, the myths that shadowed what historians wrote from then on for some time. Now, there is no evidence that Petrov's defection influenced the outcome of the 1954 election. Menzies was aware of the Petrov documents and aware that they alleged that three of Evatt's staff had questionable contact with the Soviet embassy, but Menzies made no reference to the Petrov matter in the campaign. If he had, he'd have finished Evatt. All the debate in the federal election of 54 was over the economy and eventually over Labor's inability to cost its promises, something we're familiar with in more recent times. Just one Labor anti-communist MP made a statement in the campaign that might have damaged Evatt. Bill Burke in Victoria spoke that Evatt would need to revise its promises on abolishing the means test. His intervention came and went in a day. The rivalry on the hustings was tense as election day neared, so much so that the Sydney Morning Herald's Canberra correspondents commented that while restrained in public, Menzies and Evatt made no secret of their dislike for one another. It became seen as a contest between just two men. In time, the election defeat would let loose Evatt's well-known tendency to volcanic outbursts and paranoia. Over years, this had been common with his staff at moments he thought were to his disadvantage, and here was a bigger moment, much more to his disadvantage. Evatt had never faced off against Menzies in such a major campaign, one that was meant to hand him the Prime Ministership and the prize he had worked for over a decade. As Menzies had rightly noted, so much of Evatt's career was all about him. And so it was that what happened to Labor after the 1954 federal election was fundamentally about what happened to Evatt. After the election, the Petrov Royal Commission began its hearings, and from Thursday, the 1st of July, explosive revelations from the Petrovs and others of espionage activity at the Soviet embassy in Canberra hit the headlines daily. It was here that Evatt made his first serious mistake by insisting he represent his three staffers named in the Petrov documents, Dazeal, Grunderman and O'Sullivan. Ben Chifley had been correct in his assessment to Fred Daly shortly before his death that Evatt was not leadership material. During his appearances in the court, Evatt greatly annoyed the commissioners in addition to arguing that the defection of Petrov had been a ploy by Menzies to bring down the Labor opposition at the federal election. The accusation would absorb Labor supporters for decades and create myths that took years to disprove. It also showed that Evatt was preoccupied with absolving himself from blame for the election defeat and passing that blame on to Menzies, something he'd done on his staff for years. Evatt spent most of August away from Parliament, appearing before the Commission. His obsession with the Commission continued into September, patience in caucus wore thin, and by the 8th of September, press reports of disorder in caucus were followed by an Adelaide News article headed, "Is Dr. Evatt Facing a Nervous Breakdown?" By the 16th of September, it was open war between the Commissioners and Evatt, with the Commissioners refusing to allow Evatt to appear before them. Parliamentary Labor felt leaderless and without a strategy. Menzies stood atop a diminishing opponent, which he would do for the next two elections since Labor was unable to get rid of Evatt. And especially at this time that Arthur Corwell, who may have been able to unite the party and while siding with the Labor anti-communists in caucus, showed no inclination to challenge Evatt. In time, debates in the House would show a dominant Menzies facing a dysfunctional Evatt, which, as Paul has pointed out, was probably as much a reason why he couldn't win an election. On the 5th of October 1954, something snapped in Evatt. He released a press statement exploding into headlines the following day. He accused members outside the parliamentary wing in Victoria of acting with increasing disloyalty, enough to bring the matter before the federal executive of the party. He claimed this was a factor that told heavily against us in Victoria in the 1954 federal election. Now, he didn't mention any names. He didn't mention Santa Maria, but he did mention Santa Maria's Newsweekly. And the message was clear that Santa Maria's movement, according to Evatt, had lost Labor the 1954 federal election, another of the myths that Labor historians continued for decades. The scapegoating that would explode in a split had started. At the caucus meeting on the 13th of October, as many have recorded, inflamed emotions took over. On a vote for the leadership, a minority voted against Evatt, ended with Evatt standing on a table shouting, "Take down their names." Fred Daly recorded as manic Evatt, writing, "It was Evatt and Ward at their hating best." He added that the two seemed to be enjoying it. What Evatt unleashed that day turned into a dictatorial purge of the party, the sort of authoritarian use of power that Evatt had condemned in his campaign against the Communist Dissolution Bill. It was an act of self-destruction not easily understood in today's politics. And so it was that after years of personal battles between Menzies and Evatt, which had ended in such a bitter election defeat, and the hysteria of his involvement in the Petrov Royal Commission, which affected his grip on leadership, Evatt made a manic move. As Menzies well knew, Evatt's temperament was spasmodic and erratic under pressure. In the game of political contest, this was the darkest moment for the Doc Bert Evatt. And I conclude, to me, that Menzies' rival with Evatt and his defeat of Labor at the 1954 election were fundamental to the split in 1954 to 55. Thank you.
Thank you to Georgina and Zach for organising this event and facilitating me being here today. I'm very delighted to be here. Killen, you are magnificent. For many years, it was part of Australian political folklore that this was how an exultant Prime Minister, Robert Menzies, congratulated the young backbencher James Killen when, after the distribution of preferences, the Queenslander narrowly won his seat of Moreton, thus allowing the Liberal Country Party coalition to scrape back into office in December 1961. It turned out, however, that the story was apocryphal. Killen admitted in his 1985 memoir that he had concocted it to help a Courier Mail journalist hunting for a news break. The truth was far more quotidian. The only contact Killen received from Menzies was a perfunctory phone call in which a subdued Prime Minister said, Well, laddie, this is good news. I'm glad it's over. It's been quite a strain. In retrospect, there was always grounds to suspect that Killen's story was a fable. The exuberant wording was all wrong. The Olympian Menzies did not unbend himself in that way with colleagues, and certainly not with a junior government member. The message lacked the gravitas of the great man. There was a bigger reason, though, why Menzies was unlikely to have gushed at Killen in terms that he was the government saviour. The Prime Minister knew well that a seat in Queensland had not been the decisive difference between victory and defeat in the election. Rather, it was due to the state of Victoria that his government had hung on. The figures demonstrate this. In the 1961 election, Labor gained a seat share of only 30.3% in the House of Representatives in Victoria, which was the same level of representation it had been anchored on since the party split in 1955. The Labor seat share of 30.3% in Victoria in 1961 compared to 58.7% in New South Wales, 61.1% in Queensland, 54.6% in South Australia, 33.3% in WA and 60% in Tasmania. In other words, if not for events in Victoria, namely the Labor split and its disastrous aftermath for the party in that state, the Menzies era would have ended in 1961, as Paul indicated before. This paper addresses the role of Victorian political exceptionalism as it relates to Menzies' ascendancy. The paper suggests that the chief feature of that exceptionalism was the chronic weakness of the Labor Party in the state. Further, it argues that Labor's infirmity was crucial to the state being the epicentre of the ALP split in 1955. The split was fundamentally a Victorian phenomenon, with the Victorian ALP effectively sacrificed because of its record as the worst performing of the Labor branches. In turn, the paper highlights the split's devastating effect on the ALP in Victoria, an effect which, as the 1961 election result highlighted, all but insulated the Menzies government from defeat. So now, the theme of Victorian exceptionalism. Now, we live in an era in which Labor is the party of government in Victoria. Since the early 1980s, the ALP has ruled over Spring Street for three quarters of the time, while over the same period, Labor has won the two-party preferred vote in Victoria in federal elections on no fewer than 14 out of 16 occasions. Little wonder John Howard has grumbled that Victoria is the Massachusetts of Australia. Yet this recent Labor ascendancy is an inversion of the dominant pattern of Victoria's electoral history for most of the 20th century. If there was a defining characteristic of Victorian politics throughout that period, a note of exceptionalism, it was Labor's electoral underperformance. Compared to its counterparts in the other states, Victorian Labor was the last to form government, a burlesque fortnight-long administration in 1913, and the last to form majority government, not until 1952. Labor's share of government in Victoria during the first half of the 20th century vividly illustrates its uncompetitiveness. That share was a trifling 12.7%. which compared to 67.7% in Queensland, 51.6% in WA, 46.4% in Tasmania, 41.1% in New South Wales, and 26.8% in South Australia. So why was the Victorian ALP the poor relation of the state Labor branches? In part, its weakness was congenital. The strength of the liberal protectionist tradition in colonial Victoria and deep attachment of the local labour movement, especially older-style craft unions, to that tradition retarded the movement's embrace of independent political organisation. Whereas in the other colonies, trade unions were forming Labor parties in the early 1890s, Melbourne's Trade Hall prevaricated about direct working class political representation. The first incarnation of political Labor in Victoria was the Progressive Political League, which emerged to contest the 1892 election. But it was more a subsidiary of liberalism than an autonomous political force. There were two more attempts to get Labor off the ground in Victoria over the following decade before it finally gained organisational permanency under the title of the Political Labor Council in 1901. Already by that time, the party had developed an inferiority complex, comparing itself unfavourably to Labor's strapping youngsters in New South Wales and Queensland. Another serious and enduring handicap for Labor stemmed from Victoria's economic geography. Victoria was easily the most metropolitan-dominated of the eastern seaboard colonies come states. It lacked the vast grazing tracts of New South Wales and Queensland, and also hemmed in by the spread of agricultural smallholding, Victoria's pastoral industry was at its productive limits by the end of the 19th century. Similarly, gold mining was declining as an employer, and unlike New South Wales, Victoria lacked workable black coal. The result was a chiefly urban-based constituency for Labor, which was markedly different to the situations in New South Wales and Queensland, where Australia's pastoral industry was concentrated and where the early Labor parties were strongly rooted in the mobilisation of shearers and small farmers. In Victoria, by way of contrast, Labor's principal constituency was industrial workers in a ring of inner Melbourne suburbs, supplemented by limited bases of support in regional centres in Ballarat, Bendigo, Geelong, and some of the larger towns in Gippsland. In short, Victorian Labor was predominantly an enclave party of industrial Melbourne. This presented an especial problem for the party because of the severe malapportionment of the state's electoral system, a situation that, distant from government, it was helpless to correct. Although the weighting of rural seats was not unique to Victoria, that malapportionment had grown to extreme levels by the early 20th century. This biased heavily penalised Labor because so much of its vote was bottled up in Melbourne's industrial suburbs. To put it another way, the party's support was sequestered in the wrong place, greatly diminishing its prospect of winning government in the state. Now, being locked out of power had detrimental consequences for Victorian Labor, consequences that further hindered its chances of becoming a party of government. Because of the parliamentary party's remoteness from office, it won little prestige and remained mostly under tight control by Melbourne Trades Hall. The industrialists were in turn equivocal about the value of parliamentary action for the reason that it delivered so little to them. Another consequence of Labor's lack of experience of executive government was that the party had a more oppositional and radical culture than its state counterparts. It developed a consoling but self-defeating mindset of finding vindication in righteous defeat. During World War I, it was the hub of the anti-conscription movement and intractable in its determination to punish anyone who strayed from that cause. Out of office at that time, unlike the New South Wales branch, it avoided a serious split. Though in minority government during the Great Depression crisis, the hemorrhaging was also largely contained, with only its leader, Ned Hogan, and three other renegades expelled, which was in sharp contrast to the devastating carnage in New South Wales. The dodging of a major schism on these two occasions was to have disastrous effects in the mid-1950s. So now, turning to why Victoria is the epicentre of the split of the 1950s. The party splintered elsewhere, but with a different character, intensity and scale to the Victorian cataclysm, those schisms were relative sideshows. Now, there are at least two factors at play in making Victoria the focus of the 1950s split. The first, which I'll only fleetingly refer to, was the distinctive nature of the Catholic anti-communist mobilisation in Victoria. Formed at a small gathering at BA Santa Maria's Melbourne home in August 1941, the Catholic anti-communist movement was uniquely aggressive and doctrinaire in Victoria. As fountainhead of the movement's ideology, Santa Maria's leadership was a chief reason for that zeal. The second major factor why the split centred in Victoria was Labor's arrested development in the state. As I've explained, Victorian Labor was a creature of the Melbourne's Trades Hall, a party that lacked a governing culture and which has sustained itself through its long fellow years by ritual incantations about its purity. Ironically, at the very point of escalating factional tensions within the party due to the activities of anti-communist Catholic militants, Labor in Victoria achieved a major breakthrough in 1952 when, under the leadership of John Cain Sr., for the first time in its history, it won majority government in the state, an achievement largely due to the chaotic condition of the non-Labor side of politics. Now, the Cain government of 52-55 was legislatively productive, but it was bedevilled by industrial disputation. There was a reflection of intensifying antagonism between the Labor movement's industrial and political wings, which was another cause of the party schism of 1955. Put simply, Trades Hall, which, as I have said, was at best ambivalent about parliamentarism, declared war on the Cain government. What the historian of the Labor Party split, Robert Murray, has described as industrial wing messianism was embodied by the ageing Secretary of Trades Hall, Vic Stout. Ross Fitzgerald has correctly summed up the ancestry of the madness that drove Stout and his Trade Hall allies on in the mid-1950s. Quote, "Much of the industrial wing of the Victorian branch of the ALP was not interested in reformist governments that wanted incremental change. Unlike its counterparts in New South Wales and Queensland, Victorian Labor had never enjoyed an extended period of majority government and remained in many ways an anti-parliamentary party. Many trade unionists, distrusting the compromises of parliamentary politics, held these views, and Stout faithfully reflected them. As a consequence, Stout seemed quite happy for the split to go ahead." Unquote. Labor's doleful history in Victoria contributed to the split of the 50s in other ways. Decades of parliamentary impotence and a desultory record of legislative achievement encouraged a tendency for the Victorian branch and the Cain government to be treated as expendable. Moreover, the party's deeply rooted oppositional culture was antithetical to the kind of pragmatic, self-preserving instinct necessary to guide it through the crisis. The contrast with New South Wales in this period was great. There, both the trade union movement and the Catholic Church leadership better appreciated the benefits of Labor in power. The party there had been in office continuously since the early 40s, and an attitude of compromise prevailed there. Victoria was different from New South Wales too, in that it had previously avoided a catastrophic showdown between its political and industrial wings. This was another legacy of its scant experience of office. Relations between a relatively weak parliamentary party and a powerful Trades Hall had been generally harmonious. The party had weathered the storms of World War I and the Great Depression. But this also meant the Victorian branch had not been inoculated against the perils of a full-blown split. What had been postponed in the past was played out with ferocity in the mid-1950s as the industrialists seized the opportunity of the crisis triggered by the activities of the anti-communist crusaders to brutally assert their authority over the political wing. Victoria became a sacrificial lamb for all sides of the dispute. Frank McManus, one of the movement activists, later recalled in his memoirs his realisation in 1955 that their northern allies were prepared to cut them adrift, writing, quote, "It became painfully obvious that the movement and the groupers in New South Wales had decided that Victoria was expendable and that their objectives should be to save New South Wales and themselves," unquote. Dinny Lovegrove, a key power broker of Victorian Labor, put it more clinically, quote, "The New South Wales men are prepared to fight to the last Victorian," unquote. And so it was. So, to concluding section, the split in Victoria as a gift to Menzies. Now, I haven't got time to go into detail about the legacies of the split for Victorian Labor. Suffice to say that the split worsened the party's historic pathologies. Harried by the split's bastard child, the breakaway Democratic Labor Party, which was far stronger in Victoria than in any other state, the post-split Victorian ALP's defining features were anti-Catholicism and anti-parliamentarism. The latter, as we have seen, had a long pedigree in the party, but it was given tremendous additional impetus by the split. A myth of Victorian Labor in the post-split years was that the trade unions had been the saviour of the party from infiltration by the movement. This mythology lent legitimacy to the industrial wing's dictatorial supremacy. Trade unions, particularly left-wing industrial unions, dominated the party's central executive and willfully coerced the politicians. Those unions were little interested in parliamentary power, preferring a condition of ideological chastity. When Gough Whitlam said, famously said, only impure, he was referring to the post-split Victorian ALP. The dysfunction of the post-split Victorian ALP was a gift to Menzies and also to Henry Bolte, the state's Liberal Party Premier from 1955. The figures illustrate the catastrophic electoral effects of the split on Labor in Victoria, showing incontrovertibly that the Liberal Party was the chief beneficiary of those effects. Concentrating on the federal elections of 55, 58 and 61, the ALP's average primary vote in Victoria in those elections was 39.4%. This compared to 49.6% in New South Wales, 49.5% in South Australia, 48.8% in Tasmania and 42.6% in both Queensland and WA. This amounted to a mean Labor primary vote in the non-Victorian states of 46.6%, which was more than 7% higher than the Victorian average. The ALP's average seat share in the House of Representatives in Victoria in those three elections was 30.3%, was also worse than in any other state excepting WA. The Victorian Labor's dismal electoral position was due to the split is demonstrated by the fact that the Liberal Party's primary vote in Victoria was not superior to its performance in the other states. At the three elections of 55, 58 and 1961, the Liberal Party gained an average vote of 38% in Victoria, which trailed behind 38.2% in New South Wales, 43.8% in South Australia, 42.9% in WA and 44.1% in Tasmania. That its position was unassailable in Victoria was directly due to the watertight preferences it received from the Democratic Labor Party and its forerunner, the Anti-Communist Labor Party. The DLP averaged a primary vote of 15.2% in Victoria in the three federal elections of 55, 58 and 61. This was far above its support in any of the other states, with its mean vote in the non-Victorian states just 7%, or less than half its level in Victoria. The flow-on of preferences from the DLP to Menzies Liberal Party enabled the latter to enjoy an average share of the House of Representatives seats in Victoria in the elections of 55, 58 and 61 of 56.6%, which was better than its performance in any other state bar WA. So, in sum, that Victoria was the jewel in the Liberal crown during this period can be attributed to the exceptionalism of politics in the state, an exceptionalism manifest in Labor's woeful electoral underperformance. Labor was, to put it mildly, a failed political project in Victoria. This was, as I have shown, a peculiarity with a long history, but which had been further entrenched by the 1955 split. Indeed, in the years following the split, Victoria was effectively a one-party government state, that party being the Liberal Party. Menzies' unrivalled supremacy in this period can be understood as, I would submit, a direct function of the split. Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode of Afternoon Light, the podcast of the Robert Menzies Institute. Please make sure to subscribe and catch up on our latest online content on our website or on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook.